Remaking Thanksgiving, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Sean Sherman grew up on a Native American reservation, and he learned all the same Thanksgiving myths about pilgrims and Indians.
We still cut out, you know, hand turkeys and made pilgrim hats and Indian feathers.
Later on, he learned the true story.
The first instance of Thanksgiving that you find really comes from some of those early colonists after completely wiping out a Pequot tribe.
So faced with the choice, give up on the holiday or redefine it, he chose the latter. And this writer is also reinventing the holiday.
I have, I think, about 100 people coming over, most of whom are LGBT asylum seekers from Russia.
Stories about new Thanksgiving traditions ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I'm guessing things might be a bit hectic in your kitchen today, but if you're a bit anxious about cooking for friends and family, spare a thought for Masha Gessen. The Russian-American journalist is expecting no less than 100 dinner guests for a home-cooked Thanksgiving meal today. Many of them are strangers. Most are LGBT asylum seekers from various parts of the world. For many, it will be their first Thanksgiving here in the U.S. I gave Gessen a ring earlier today to check in on the meal prep. Hi, Masha. It's Carol in Boston.
Hi, Carol. How are you?
Good, good. I know you're cooking.
I was actually washing potatoes. I have, I think, about 100 people coming over. So I'm a little frazzled.
Wow, 100.
So what I do is I just cook several turkeys. I've got two in the oven right now and two that are going to be popped in after those two come out. And I ask other people to bring other stuff. So I'm just providing the turkeys, the cranberry sauce, and the mashed potatoes.
Tell us who's coming to dinner.
Well, I don't know, actually. What I do every year is and this is the fifth year that I've been doing it, is I create a Facebook event and I invite people I know who are either Russian LGBT asylum seekers or work with Russian LGBT asylum seekers. And then I encourage them to invite people that I may not know, especially recent arrivals. So it's mostly newcomers. I'm mostly going to be meeting people for the first time.
You sort of have the gateway Thanksgiving event for a lot of new LGBT refugees.
That's the idea. There are several Central Asian countries where it's extremely difficult to be queer. So a lot of people are coming over. There are people who are coming from Ukraine, which is a much better place to be queer, but still not a great place, and also is war-torn. So people have lots of reasons to be coming. So, you know, and Ukraine and Russia are at war, but asylum seekers are not.
So this is now a tradition. You've been doing it for several years. What will be different about it this year?
There's been quite a change over the last 5 years for asylum seekers. You know, not that I'm completely unconflicted about Thanksgiving ever, but certainly 5 years ago, I could say that for all the problems with the holiday itself and with this country, it was for LGBT people around the world a beacon of hope. The U.S. has been one of the very few countries that have been granting asylum on the basis of anti-gay persecution. Most European countries, most other countries actually that grant asylum don't grant asylum on this basis. So this was indeed a place where people could come with a high probability, get asylum, and live safely. What was most striking to me actually about when I first came back was that people would come, you know, and they would be asylum seekers, so they were here legally. But they had really no legal rights. They don't have the right to work yet. You don't get it until you've been in the country for a year. They had trouble doing simple things like opening a bank account or renting an apartment. And yet they all said that they felt safer than they had in Russia. Even in a strange country where you don't speak the language and you don't have any rights, certainly no political rights, they felt safer. It was incredibly striking, and I felt like it was something to be celebrated. It's still true that this is a safer place than Russia, but certainly the country's attitude toward immigrants has changed drastically. I think it's highly problematic at this point to hold it out as a beacon of hope. The fact of the matter is that there is no country at this point in the world where LGBT refugees can go. And so it's a very bittersweet kind of holiday. We're lucky to be here, but other people may not be able to come.
I know on Thanksgiving, you often think about your mother and a particular letter she wrote. I know she was a Russian language literary critic, and she died in 1992. I wonder if you're thinking about her words again this year.
I do. I think about them a lot. She wrote this beautiful essay about Thanksgiving and about sort of the nature of finding a home in a strange land. Just contained this incredible description of the amount of time it takes and the sense of belonging nowhere, and then gradually acquiring the markers and the sense of things that you can stick your soul to, as she put it, because you don't actually land somewhere and start feeling at home. It's an incredibly long and painful process, but it does occur, and eventually you feel that you belong somewhere, partly because you know people, partly because you have established traditions. And so I think that's why she wrote that essay about Thanksgiving.
I actually have a couple lines from your mother's letter. She wrote, "I have a persistent aversion to the very concept of patriotism, thanks to the forced lessons of Soviet patriotism. I find myself saying thank you to a world we have chosen and mastered, a world that has been kind to us. This is an imperfect world, a complicated one, at times impossible to understand, and it has become our home." Well, that's a very, very moving letter.
Thank you. I'm hoping that this is kind of a contribution to people feeling at home and feeling like they have tradition.
I'm curious, for you, you've started and restarted Thanksgiving. You came to the U.S. as a teenager from the Soviet Union, and then you came back again around 2012, 2013, and have re-embraced Thanksgiving. What are the key differences in how you celebrate it now than when you celebrated it back when you were younger?
Well, I think this difference actually has more to do with getting older, right? There's one of the rites of passage is that you go from going to your parents' house for Thanksgiving to having other people come to you for Thanksgiving. So this is a rather expansive way of having people come to me for Thanksgiving. But to me, it does bring a sense of maturity. Again, I think about my mother. She died when she was quite young. In fact, she died when she was younger than I am. So I feel like I don't have a mother to go home to. I haven't had one in a long time, but that's the refugee condition as well, is you can't go home to your parents. You can't be with them when you would be celebrating anything. And so that makes chosen families or logical families so much more important.
Masha Gessen is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. On this Thanksgiving Day, the commander-in-chief got on the phone with a few American military officers stationed in different parts of the world. Afterward, President Trump was asked if there's a plan for him to make his first ever visit to U.S. troops in a war zone.
I'm looking forward to going to Afghanistan or going to the Middle East.
We're
going to
do some interesting things at the appropriate time. We'll be doing some very interesting things.
Trump did not give any details. He was also asked about Saudi Arabia. And once again, the president cast doubt on what the CIA reportedly concluded, namely that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, likely knew about the killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Here's Trump speaking with reporters at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, earlier today.
We have a very strong ally in Saudi Arabia. We have an ally that said they did not commit at the top level. The crown prince, the king, they did not commit this atrocity. And it's an atrocity. It's a terrible thing. I dislike it more than you do.
He went on to praise Saudi Arabia for opening up and doing a lot of good things. But news reports in recent days tell a very different story. They say Saudi security forces have jailed and tortured numerous women's rights activists. Karim Fahim has been writing about it for The Washington Post.
The activists are a group of women and a few men who were arrested beginning in May. The arrests of the activists was particularly striking because it happened a few weeks before the Saudi government lifted a ban on women driving in the kingdom.
Are some of the women who were arrested the women we would see in videos occasionally online of driving around in Saudi Arabia and defying the law?
Yes, absolutely. Some of them had posted videos before the repeal of the ban. Some of them had submitted petitions to the royal court asking for either the repeal of the ban or other rights for women. Some of them were extremely well known and some of them were not as well known and had sort of agitated more quietly.
And was the stated reason for their detention in May, the ones who are drivers and who are women, was it for driving or were they simply detained and no charges levied?
No, it had nothing to do with driving. What we've been told is that they were detained because they were seeking to pass information to as yet unnamed hostile foreign powers. But the Saudi government has not provided much more detail than that.
Now, the news, of course, is that there are reports that some of the people detained in May have been tortured. What is alleged to have happened and what is the evidence for it?
Well, we've heard that this group of women have faced psychological and physical abuse while in detention. It's ranged from things like sleep deprivation, threats, to floggings, electric shocks. There have also been some allegations of sexual abuse in the prison, which has also shocked people because those things generally do not happen to women in Saudi prisons, from what we understand.
Have you been able to independently confirm the claims?
No, it's very difficult. I mean, part of the problem is that the women and their families, and really many prisoners in Saudi Arabia, are strictly warned not to speak to people about the conditions of their detention. But the people we spoke to, some of them have firsthand knowledge of what's happening. Other human rights groups have also reported on these conditions in the last few days, as well as other press outlets.
Have Saudi authorities responded to these charges, to these claims of torture?
They've responded sort of generally and said that torture and abuse are not part of the judicial process or of interrogations, but they haven't responded to the specific charges raised in the cases of these women.
Is there a sense that these women were arrested as part of a crackdown that has occurred under Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman?
Yeah, I think the arrests are seen as part of a broader trend under Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who has really tried to silence political opposition, but also people who tend to stick their head up too far. You know, so that's included the very famous roundup of business executives and some princes at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel back in November. A month before that roundup, there were arrests of prominent clerics, and then there were the women's rights advocates.
And just one final thing. Mohammed bin Salman did, as we know, lift the ban on women driving. So women are driving in Saudi Arabia now, aren't they?
They are, yes. They did start driving in late June. That's one of those sort of significant reforms that has excited a lot of young people, especially inside the kingdom, and excited women, and that, you know, people had focused on with good reason for a long time, but to the exclusion maybe of other things that were happening there.
The Washington Post's Karim Fahim speaking to us from Istanbul. Thanks, Karim.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, a Native American chef is reinventing Thanksgiving. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. If you grew up here in the U.S., you most certainly learned all about the history of Thanksgiving in school. And it was something like this.
In the year 1621, the Pilgrims held their first Thanksgiving feast. They invited the great Indian chief, Massasoit, who brought 90 of his brave Indians and a great abundance of food. Governor William Bradford and Captain Miles Standish were honored guests.
All due respect to Linus, but a lot of what we've been taught about Thanksgiving is just plain wrong. What gets left out or downplayed is what actually happened to Indigenous people living in North America. As a result, many Native Americans today don't celebrate Thanksgiving at all. Chef Sean Sherman has made a different choice. He's known as the Sioux Chef. That's S-I-O-U-X, Sioux, as in Oglala Lakota Sioux Tribe. Chef Sherman, growing up on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, what did you learn about Thanksgiving?
I started school in the early 80s, and we learned the same story of the pilgrims and Indians getting together in the early days and the big feast that they had. So the same that everybody learns.
Even though you were in a school with mostly Native Americans, you still learned the sort of traditional Thanksgiving story.
Exactly. We still cut out, you know, hand turkeys and made pilgrim hats and Indian feathers, even though we were on the reservation.
And what did you and your family do on Thanksgiving Day when you were growing up?
We had big family celebrations, so our entire family would get together, all of my aunts and uncles and cousins and so forth, and we just have a big, very typical Thanksgiving feast.
When did things begin to change for you about the holiday?
Well, you know, my family stopped gathering after my grandparents passed away when I was pretty young. I was like 18, I suppose. And I moved off the reservation and, you know, I kind of entered a world of culinary eventually, and I became a chef in Minneapolis. And I started really focusing on trying to understand what my Lakota ancestors were eating. And it really made me understand the history of Native America so much deeper because of all of that research.
There's a lot that people mislearn in school about Thanksgiving. I mean, how different is what you learn in school from the real story?
Quite a bit. You know, you find out that, you know, George Washington tries to start a national holiday called Thanksgiving that has nothing to do with that story, but it doesn't stick. And then President Lincoln actually puts it into play. But again, the holiday is based on unity and trying to get people to get together because he was in a very divisive time in history. And again, it had nothing to do with that Pilgrims and Indians story. That story actually comes around towards the turn of the century after the U.S. has pretty much taken over all the indigenous land in the West. And there's this huge influx of immigrants coming to America. And therefore, this huge rise of nationalism starts in the United States, and people are really utilizing this colonial perspective and ideology as what true Americanism is, and they forcibly, you know, put these values into school systems. So that's why we learn about things like this colonial perspective of Thanksgiving, you know, which was a very much a fabricated tale just to kind of instill American values into people, especially the immigrants.
And what's the real story? What's the kind of stuff you learned that really happened?
So the first instance of Thanksgiving that you find really comes from some of those early colonists after completely wiping out a Pequot tribe. And, you know, it's a brutal massacre. There's many men and women and children completely burned. And it's a horrible story. But the colonists celebrate at a time of Thanksgiving and try to declare that. So in history, that's the first time you see that word being used for that kind of celebration. And there were instances of feasts between the two here and there, but not like the stories that we hear.
And we're talking about in the 1600s, around 1627, that the first kind of notion of some feast being had. But it's really to celebrate killing Native Americans, not joining hands.
Exactly. And even, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, they write merciless, savage Indians as a quote in the Declaration of Independence. And that really, you know, says so much about what the U.S. government thought of the indigenous peoples that were still living in a huge area across North America.
Do you still convene with your family on Thanksgiving Day? And if so, what do you celebrate?
No, we think that Thanksgiving, you know, it's a national holiday and we really should drop that native narrative because it has nothing to do with indigenous peoples. But we really just focus on, you know, what can be good for everybody. We don't need that, you know, false story of unity to come to unite us, you know, in the present day. So we really try to, you know, make it all about gratitude, Thanksgiving, and just having, you know, lots of amazing food. So we use a lot of game. We use a lot of wild foods and foraged foods. We use a lot of Native American agricultural pieces in general. And we do that typically on a day-to-day basis. But on Thanksgiving, it gives us an excuse to have a big feast. So we'll have things like cedar-raised rabbit or some bison or duck or turkey or wild rice. And a lot of those Thanksgiving dishes are already kind of indigenous themed with, you know, turkeys and pumpkins and corn and beans and squash and so forth. We just really celebrate with lots of fun food.
Chef Sean Sherman is the founder and CEO of The Sous Chef, a group that's committed to revitalizing Native American cuisine. Thanks a lot, Chef Sherman.
Thank you, guys.
So from a native Sioux chef, we turn now to Russian chef Dima King. Dima is an asylum seeker from St. Petersburg. He's preparing his very first Thanksgiving dinner today, but only after a full day of cooking and serving hundreds of customers at work. Dima joins us from the Temple Court Restaurant in New York City. Dima, before we talk about Thanksgiving, I want you to tell us your story. You're an asylum seeker here in the U.S. Why did you feel that your life was in danger in Russia?
I would like to say that it's not a safe place for anybody, but especially for gay people.
What was happening to you in Russia that made you want to leave?
About 2 years ago, me and my husband being attacked by unknown people, and we've been prosecuted by the government, by police. And we decided it's not a safe place for us anymore, and we decided just to escape.
Today, you're celebrating Thanksgiving for the first time, and you're working at a restaurant all day. That got me thinking that so many people with service jobs in the U.S. are immigrants like yourself. Is this something that you think about today on this Thanksgiving Day?
Yes, of course. I would like to thank all the people who works with me. And I think I will be right if I say there are a lot of Americans who work as well.
That's true, like me, but
yes,
right here.
Correct.
But anyway, did you know anything about Thanksgiving when you lived in Russia?
Of course, I knew it's a holiday of celebrating of union of new Americans and Native Americans together. It's the greatest meal of the year.
Dima, you've been cooking all day, and I know you're going to go home and cook up another big meal to celebrate Thanksgiving. Why bother? Why is it important to you to take part in Thanksgiving?
For me, Thanksgiving is the day that I can celebrate with my friends and family, just to cook something for them, to make them joy. And, of course, I would like to participate in this holiday as American history, as American culture.
Chef Dima King speaking to us from the Temple Court Restaurant in Manhattan about his first American Thanksgiving. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, a history of Braille. Before Braille came into widespread use, the world of words was largely closed to people without sight.
Pretty much blind people weren't going to school at all. The idea of literacy just wasn't even on the radar.
What about now in the era of smartphones? Do blind people still need Braille? That story's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. On this Thanksgiving Day, we'd like to play you a story that we first aired this past summer. The World's Patrick Cox is our reporter.
Hey, Carol.
Hey, Patrick.
Let me start by playing you something.
The next station is Westminster. Change.
So, as you can hear, I was in London. I was with my daughter, and we were doing, you know, the usual London stuff, going to touristy places. And along the way, we were testing out this app. It's called Over There.
T-bar, 69 feet.
Over there. So what does it do?
It's kind of like a speaking GPS or speaking Google Maps, and it's designed for blind people to orient themselves. So you point your phone in any direction, and the app just starts listing off places.
Chelsea Football Club Stadium, 200 feet. Chelsea
I get
Football
the idea.
Stadium,
your favorite soccer team.
Mm.
And this app called Over There tells you the places that are tagged on digital maps, and it's reading them out loud to you?
That's right. And there's all kinds of audio nuances that further help to orient you. Like, the tag place sounds clear when you point directly at it, but it's a little more staticky if you veer away from it a bit. It's one of the many ways in which digital designers are trying to keep blind people abreast of technological advancement. And here's the interesting thing. You can use this app even if you have absolutely no literacy in Braille.
Because, of course, the app is speaking to you.
Right.
So Braille, you mentioned it, it's the writing system for the blind. But this all begs the question, how much do blind people actually need Braille these days?
Yeah, I had the same question. And I knew if I wanted to get a handle on whether or not Braille is vital today and how vital it may be in the future, I needed to know how it came into being, courtesy of that young Frenchman Louis Braille, how it came into being in the first place.
It has dots.
Embossed on signs, on paper. Cute dots.
We're going to draw them on the board. There's dots.
This is Sherry Wells Jensen, and she's doing her impression of how not to teach Braille and its history. Sherry's a linguistics professor at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. And blind Braille readers, they have to put up with a lot of bad Braille history, usually told by sighted people. What about before there were dots, though? Before there was Braille?
Pretty much blind people weren't going to school at all. The idea of literacy just wasn't even on the radar. The only thing that blind people could read were things that other people wrote for them. So that you had no note-taking, no journaling, no recording your great thoughts.
So literally, if you wanted to write something back, you would have to get a sighted person to write it down for you.
Right. You'd have to get them to be the scribe, and after they'd written it, then they would have to decide to go ahead and emboss that for you. So writing anything down for yourself was probably a 2 or 3 step process.
So Louis Braille was born in 1809. He was actually born sighted and then became blinded in an accident in his early childhood. He went to a school for the blind in Paris, and that is where he learned his ABCs with the help of those clunky embossed letters. So what was it about him that made him reject his lot in life and seek something more? Figuring this question out isn't that straightforward.
It's really hard to find sort of a realistic biography of Louis Braille because, you know, you read some of these biographies and he's just descended from angels and he was this amazing, special, I don't know. A lot of them are really awfully sappy, so it's hard to get a handle on who the fellow was, really. But there was something about his parents, I think. There was something about the way he was raised. Their, I don't know if you would say insistence or willingness to just let him bang around the house and figure things out and come and go as he wanted to. And it seemed to me that they did not spend a lot of time trying to control his motions. A lot of times, blind kids are raised with a lot of don't touch, sit still, be careful. And I think he was gifted with this kind of freedom to fall downstairs and climb trees and run around and just be a kid. And I think that makes such a crucial difference at a young age for kids.
Okay, so here's this fearless boy with all of this built-in freedom. And France, at the time, it was a huge power politically, intellectually, and especially militarily. Napoleon Bonaparte, he'd been waging war all over Europe. And it was a French battlefield innovation that gave Louis Braille, the school kid, his idea.
People were always coming to the school, apparently, with the latest wacky new thing that was going to give blind people literacy. And one of the things that came through was a system of night writing, it was called, that they were using for military purposes, because you don't want to light your lantern in the middle of the night on the front line to read it, right? Because, boom, there you are.
It served a need, night writing, and it used code. Lines and dashes represented sounds. It was fast to read and handy under the fingertips. And that was all the inspiration that 15-year-old Louis Braille needed. Of course, he also needed to improve this writing system, to compress it.
So the blind people themselves thought, this is genius. We love this. Suddenly we're reading and writing on our own. We're not waiting for a sighted person to do XYZ for us. We can write down our own stuff. We can be rotten little 14-year-old boys and pass notes in class, right? We can do all this. We can do what we want to do. So the blind people loved it. The sighted people running the school hated it. They didn't like it partly because they didn't learn it. And so they didn't know what the kids were writing, and that's trouble. That's kids taking power away from the teachers. That's people assuming their own agency and becoming themselves. The sighted administrators of the school, they could have learned it. Anyone can learn Braille, just go ahead. But they didn't want to. And at one point, they actually went through the school, found all the kids' notes in Braille, found all the books that they had transcribed in Braille, hauled them out into the courtyard of the school, and they had themselves a book burning. Yeah, Braille book burning. You can feel them going, no, 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 no. Back that off. Back that off. You're not taking this power from us. You belong to us, you blind people. You are our philanthropy. We get a lot of prestige from, you know, taking care of you all. And your role is to sit quietly and do what we tell you to do, not invent a writing system and claim literacy and start doing your own thing.
Wow, that's staggering. So how on earth did he manage to sort of convince officialdom that this was a good thing?
I think, like all power structures, there's some people who are in it to feed their egos and to have the power. But then there were also educators of blind people at the time who really were in it for blind people, who really understood that these are people with human rights and I'm going to use my power for good. So eventually, the sighted people, on behalf of blind people, convinced each other that, yeah, we should go ahead and do this thing.
It took a few more years, but Braille became established in France, and then it spread to other countries, not always with ease. In the US, conflicting writing systems held it back for decades, and even after that was settled, many American books for children used an older form of Braille. It wasn't really until the 1950s that everyone was on the same page. So several generations of blind Americans really lost out there. I'm sure that all the publishing houses and directors of schools for the blind thought they were doing the right thing. But they weren't. They were being stubborn. Sherry Wells Jensen was luckier. She was born after all of this. Not only that, she had great family support.
My mother learned to read Braille before I did because she figured I was going to have to read it, so she might as well figure it out too. So I had the advantage of, my mom could write me a letter when I went to camp.
As a kid, she used to wait on summer mornings for the mail guy to come.
He'd pull into the driveway and toot his horn, and that meant he had a book for me. He had a book for me, whatever it was going to be, from the lending library. And I'd go tearing down the stairs and fling myself down the front porch steps and crash into his car and say, "Give it to me, give it to me." And it was this big moment that there was going to be a book. And you bet that I read every word of that book. Every word. I didn't skip a page because it was the book that there was to read for that week. But now if I want something, anything that's online, I can read in Braille. And that's amazing to me. Like I can get a book and go, I don't want to finish this. It's sort of a weird kind of freedom to be able to skip things, to know that there's another book that you can just change to if you don't like what you're reading. I can even start in the middle if I want to. But that's not what most kids get. So they get a little bit of Braille during the day, whatever is Brailled for them. They come home to a largely Brailleless environment, where sighted kids, there's just reading everywhere. Probably if you look around you right now, there's all kinds of words.
Yeah.
There's words on signs, words on just books. I don't know. I don't even know.
You're right. Yeah. It's everywhere.
I think the nearest Braille to me right now is probably out in the hallway, there might be a number on the door. And that's the only thing I can read. I'm betting it's the only thing I can read in this whole building are those numbers on the doors. Maybe it says exit. Maybe it says restroom on the restroom. But there's this absence of the written word that little kids, and adults too, but crucially that little kids experience when they're Braille readers. Whereas you are bombarded with print everywhere. There's words, words, words. And that has a marvelous beneficial effect for little kids learning to read.
Yeah, of course. And for adults, once they left school, continuing to be fully literate.
Right, and it's so easy. Like, you want to read something, there's a whole library full of hundreds of thousands of different books just sitting there on the shelf, and you don't even have to have a plan. You don't even have to know what you want. You can just walk up and say, "Oh, look, there's a blue one. I'll pick up that. It's got words in it." And the unconscious ease of words everywhere is something that you don't experience if you're a Braille reader.
Patrick, after hearing that, I'm wondering how many Braille readers and writers are out there?
Nobody knows, Carol. I mean, attempts to count them have been made many times, but it's really hard. I mean, What is fluency? Do you count people who learned Braille as children and no longer use it that much? Some people do, some people don't. So the counts are all over the place. But there is this anxiety among Braille supporters that the numbers may be down compared to a couple of decades ago. They just don't know for sure.
How does Braille keep from becoming outdated? I mean, how does it deal with internet speak and hashtags, the at sign, all caps, all that kind of stuff?
Well, they have modernized the system. There's a new standard now. It's called Unified English Braille. This addresses a bunch of these issues. But there's also technology, which means that there are new and easier ways to read and write. Many blind people read and write their emails, for example, by using text-to-speech technology.
And, of course, you can talk to your smartphone, whether you're blind or not, and it'll talk back to you. And presumably, there are quite a few apps like that when you tried out in London.
Yeah, I met the guy who designed the interface for that app. His name is Joshua Mealy. He runs a lab at the Smith Cadwell Eye Research Institute in San Francisco. He invents stuff that makes it easier for blind people to access information.
And while I am a huge Braille advocate, I use Braille every day myself. Braille is not the one solution to our information accessibility challenges.
So I guess the message is Braille has a role to play, but maybe not quite the central role that it did in the past.
Yeah. Let's throw a curveball here, though. Josh Mealy, he thinks that we also may be on the cusp of a Braille renaissance because of technology. So electronic Braille readers, which are these massive, clunky, expensive things that have actually been around for decades, there are new iterations of those readers that are being made now out of tiny components. All of that stuff is much smaller.
And much cheaper and much more reliable. And so now we can come back to that idea and say, hey, wait a second. That's actually going to work now that a servo motor is like the size of the head of a pin rather than the size of a mason jar. It's really helpful to know not only, you know, what's coming, but what's been tried and why didn't it work.
So I guess what goes around comes around. I'm wondering what Louis Braille would have made of all this. I mean, he was such an innovator. I mean, technology would have excited him.
Yes, that is very much what the person who told me about him thinks, Sherry Wells Jensen of Bowling Green State University. She's all about using technology too. But Braille, reading and writing it every day, that is still her main form of communication, her most cherished. What else would you use, she says, for your personal writing, your diary entries?
Your love letters. Can you imagine? I have to do an audio love letter? Uh-uh. No. There are things that we want to communicate that we really want to write down. And having the freedom to choose to do that when you want to, literacy is a human right. It just is.
I'm gonna love you like no one's loved you, come rain or come shine.
Patrick, did you learn any Braille while reporting this story?
I'm afraid I didn't. Well, I did learn a couple of letters from a staff member at the Andrew High School Braille and Talking Book Library in New York. We did a live show there. But I'm afraid I can't do something like Happy Thanksgiving in Braille.
Well, anyway, thank you, Patrick, and Happy Thanksgiving.
You too, Carol.
I guess when you met me.
I'm turning the rest of the program over to my colleague, Marco Werman. He recently sat down with a jazz singer, and, well, let's just start with a little of her music.
I am Magos Herrera. I'm a singer, and I'm from Mexico City, and I live in New York.
How long have you been in New York?
I have been in New York for 11 years.
Nice.
Yes.
It must feel like home now.
It does, yeah, somehow.
So the album and the music with the terrific quartet Brooklyn Rider plus a percussionist is called Dreamers, and that title doesn't refer to people going to bed and the dreams they have in their head when they're asleep. Tell us what you're referring to with the title.
I mean, clearly it has different lectures. The one that we think of, obviously, is about the dreamers in the United States. But it also refers to the dreams, to the to what we dream of. You know, these incredible singers and writers and poets in Spain and Latin America survived oppressive regimes, and through their beautiful words, poetry, songs, they stand for humanity, democracy, all these values that we believe in. And what transcends from that is that. So I thought it was a very good narrative to address these days, you know, to really step into what we believe and to keep dreaming.
Meu coração não se cansa de ter esperança de dia ser tudo que quer.
So on the recording, Dreamers, you've got two compositions by Caetano Veloso from Brazil that you cover, and one by the Chilean songwriter and singer Violeta Parra. What do their stories as artists tell us about dreamers and dreaming?
Well, as you mentioned, Caetano Veloso, Violeta Parra, Gilberto Gil, they were all, for instance, let's talk about Caetano. He lived under a dictatorship and he was exiled.
In the early 1970s from Brazil. Yeah.
That's right, just like Gilberto Gil, that regardless how these incredible minds were affected by their regimes in one way or another, we believe, we dream. We recorded a beautiful tune by Caetano, by the way. It's called De Manhã, In the Morning.
É de manhã, é de madrugada, de manhã. Não sei mais de nada, de manhã, vou ver meu amor. Vou ver minha amada de manhã, flor da madrugada de manhã, vou ver minha flor.
Tell me why you selected De Manhã for this album, and what about it spoke to you?
So all of the songs, including De Manhã, they're beautiful songs, like powerful songs that could be surrounded by simplicity, or love songs, or just nature, but they're just incredible poems. And De Manhã, it's like the first song, Caetano Veloso's first song ever recorded. So it's like his first song, De Manhã,
wow,
in the morning.
I had no idea.
So it's like very, you know, like the first thing that this brilliant mind gave us. And I just love the simplicity of it. It's just so beautiful. Is this person going to see the loved one in the early morning? And, you know, it's just very refreshing and luminous. And I think the idea of having this album was to pick luminous songs that remind us that, because I think that's one of the things that under the spirit of our time, sometimes it's hard to remember that humanity is also capable of reflecting beauty and luminosity. So to me, it was very important not to go into the political. We have enough of that, you know, out there. It's just to, in the contrary, bring and show the beauty and the dignity of Iberoamerica and the luminous side of it in words, in poetry, and in just ordinary stories about being human.
What did it feel like composing these songs and producing this particular album in these times?
It's been a long process. When I decided to do this album, it was important for me to be grounded truly where I come from, but also to start a journey with such an incredible quartet like Brooklyn Rider. It's been a fortunate learning process to me. First of all, to understand my voice within this format, you know, with strings, which acoustically it's very different from what I've been working on before. So to find my voice and to navigate in this sound that demands technically different things from me, and also the space within the instruments and the voice demands a different kind of phrasing. But also just to see the devotion of Brooklyn Rider towards music. To me, I think that, this has been the most beautiful experience about working with them, because they besides their incredible people, their devotion and the way they honor music, it's been really amazing. And they have embraced the project, not only with their artistry, but the narrative. And to me, that was the most important thing in this collaboration, that they truly understand the source and the spirit of Dreamers.
Magos Herrera, the new album is called Dreamers. She performs it with the quartet Brooklyn Rider. Thanks very much for visiting us here at The World.
Thank you so much for having me.
Magos Herrera there, speaking with The World's Marco Werman. This brings our Thanksgiving Day program to a close. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Enjoy the rest of your holiday.
PRI, Public Radio International.